Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 2, and we're going to continue moving forward here. Last week, we were able to work our way through the first 8 verses. Now, remember, this all really centers in on something that came up in the first chapter, which is God's call for us to be what? To be what?
Holy.
Holy. It's God's call for His people to live holy lives. As He says in chapter 1, be holy as I am holy. Going back to the old covenant teaching there. And so as we're moving along, He's asking us to do that. And He's showing us ways in which you and I can align our lives with that goal of becoming holy people. As we ended last week, we were looking at verses 7 and 8, where He reflects on the stone, the chief cornerstone. Of course, who is that? Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, right? He is the cornerstone, and it is off of His stone that all the other stones are laid. One of us being those if we are children of God. And then He says in verse 8, He quotes again, these two quotations here. The first one comes from Psalm 118:22. That's verse 7. And then in verse 8, the quotation is from Isaiah 8 and verse 14. And He gives us this here, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Who is Jesus a stumbling stone for? Who stumbles at Jesus? Don't believe, don't obey. What'd you say, Doug?
Jews
in particular. And if I can pull in my lesson from this morning, if you were here to hear that, those who have the hard heart, right? The word cannot penetrate their heart. They deflect any opportunity that it has to get in. And so He becomes a stumbling block for them. The end of verse 8 says, they stumble because they do what? They disobey the word as they were destined to do. Interesting phraseology there. Did God make them do this? What does He mean by destined here? What's the idea? Who destined them? Well, first, let's talk about the word destiny. What is destiny? We use that word. We hear it. It's used very romantically, and when we talk about love, you know, I'm destined to find my one, right? We talk about it in the arc of the hero's journey, right? He's destined for greatness. What does it mean to be destined for something? What you're born to do?
That's your future.
That's your future.
The New King James uses the word appointed.
Appointed, okay. It's an end that is unavoidable, right? Your destiny that you cannot escape it. Well, so if that's the idea here, that's the English word where the English Standard is using. You think about the word appointed in the King James. Who's doing the appointing or the destiny? Who's created that destiny?
Themselves. Can't be God.
Okay, I agree with you.
According to John 3:16, for God so loved the world.
Mm-hmm. Even if you go back to John 3:16, what's the whole verse say? For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever, it's that big word, it's kind of a compound word, right? Whosoever, what is whosoever?
Anyone with this condition of belief.
Yeah, it's anyone, right? Who what? Chooses to believe. Who will accept Him. Well, can we condition ourselves so that we destine ourselves for faith? Yeah, We can. But we can do the opposite too. We can so condition ourselves that no matter if the truth smacks us across the face, we reject it. If we're unwilling to hear and to believe, and I believe that's really what he's trying to say, is there are those who stumble simply because they completely refuse to hear the truth. Because in some way it violates some preconceived idea of what they think is real or true. So, yeah, and it's interesting, the very next words in verse 9 are what? But you, those who have not stumbled, are what? A chosen race. Let me go ahead and jump up here. Sorry, I'm behind on my slides. He says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellency of him who, what? Called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You are chosen, but how are you chosen? Yeah. The call goes out and you answer the call. Can anybody hear the call? Yes, but not everybody answers. Absolutely. And so he describes those who have chosen. He describes the church how? He says, you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. He's giving different descriptors of God's people, a chosen race. Of course, he's not talking about flesh, is he? He's not talking about our skin tone. He's not talking about our ethnicity. But what is he talking about? Well, he's talking about those who've chosen to become followers. Galatians 3:27, what does Paul say? For as many of you were baptized into Christ, have what? Clothed yourself with Christ. And then he goes on in the next verse to say what? There's neither what? Jew nor Greek, barbarian, Scythian, or right? And he tells us, like, you've left those former things behind. You've chosen to be a Christian. And as a Christian, you are a priest. Why don't we have a priesthood in the church? Well, we kind of do, don't we? We have a high priest, and we have all kinds of priests underneath him. But it doesn't look like what some of the religious world makes it look like, does it? We don't wear special robes. We don't have all kinds of different titles. We are a priesthood underneath the Holy Priest. Who's the high priest of the church? Jesus. Hebrews chapter 4, doesn't the Hebrews writer makes that clear, right? Since you have a high priest, right? Such a great high priest. A high priest that can sympathize with our weaknesses, because why? He was tempted in every way that we, yet without sin. Therefore, we can come before the throne of grace with boldness to help in the time of need. And so, we are a priest. If you're a Christian, you're a priest in that sense. You serve under the high priest. You're a holy nation. What's the call? To be holy as he is holy. So we're seeking holiness, a people for his own possession, so that we may do what? We may proclaim his excellencies, excellencies. That's a hard word for me to say. We are those who proclaim. We are those who proclaim the goodness of God. Because why? He called us out of darkness and into his marvelous light. I can't help but think about Colossians 1:13. You know Colossians 1:13? What does that one say? He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transported us into the kingdom of his dear Son. We've been transported out of darkness into the kingdom of light, the kingdom of Jesus. And now we've become a people. And we are his people. We are Christians. That ought to be a name that we take real encouragement from. And we should be happy to proclaim. Wearing the name of Christian is important and it is significant. I know it gets misused and people use it who are not Christians, yet we should maintain that greatness that we're able to be called followers of Christ. All right, verse 11. I have 11 up there. Let me move forward here. All right, we are a people. We are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Right? We are God's own possession. So, verse 11. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your souls. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may do what? See your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. We are in a war. And we're in a war not against, Paul will say in the Ephesian letter, right? Chapter 6, what does he say? We're not fighting against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against the evil spiritual forces. We fight against their own flesh. Romans chapter 7, right? Isn't that what he says? We are sojourners and exiles. Some older translations has the word pilgrims there. What's a sojourner? A traveler. To me, it's kind of the callback to Abraham. One of the most amazing things about Abraham's life is if you go back and read Genesis, and you start at Genesis chapter 12, how does Genesis 12 start? Anybody remember?
I'm going to make of you a great nation.
So God first offers Abraham three promises, doesn't he? Remember, there are three. I'm going to make you a great nation. What else? Okay. What?
Descendants as many as the stars.
Okay, so I'm going to make you a great nation. Descendants as sands on the seashore. He'll say it one time. Stars in the sky another time. So he's going to bless you with the great nations to come from you. What's this? I'm going to give you a land, right? I'm going to give you a land. And I'm going to bless through your seed. There's going to come a seed which will bless all the world. Right? Those are the three great promises to Abraham. What's amazing to me is then God says, before I'm jumping ahead of myself, and then God says, but there's condition. This is a covenant. Covenants come with conditions. What's the condition? What was the condition in Genesis 12? One thing. What? What? Yes, you had to leave. You had to go. God didn't say where. He just says go. He says, I'll show you. But that was the one, that was the one thing he's asking. Go. I want you to leave. I want you to leave your family, your homeland, and go. And of course, as we read that Abraham did that, he and Sarah left, and they began their journeys. But do you know, in Abraham's life, he never had any of those three promises fulfilled. He had the seeds of those promises fulfilled, but he never got to a land. He sojourned his whole life. He never had a great amount of children or a nation formed from him. And ultimately, Jesus would not come for how long? A long time, right? A long time. Like 2,000 years. You can think about that. Yet, Abraham trusted God, and as Genesis 15 says, he trusted God, and God reckoned it to him as his faith, as he reckoned his faith as righteousness. Abraham was a sojourner. Well, we are sojourners. We spend our lives as Christians as exiles, living in a land we do not belong. We don't belong here. Now, we do the best we can in the lives we have, but our home is where? It's in heaven, right? We're looking for a heavenly land. If you go over to Hebrews chapter 11, I love this text, but if you go there and look, and he gives a long list of individuals who demonstrated in their lives great amounts of faith. Hebrews chapter 11, let's go there for just a second. And let's go down. So he talks about all these individuals. So who does he talk about? Well, if you start there at verse 4, he brings up Abel. Right? Abel offers a better sacrifice. He talks about Enoch. He talks about Noah. And he talks about Abraham. And he talks about Sarah. And so he provides this, and he's going to provide us more later on. But right there in the middle of Abraham, he says, inclusive of all of these in chapter 11, he says these all died in faith. They lived their entire lives without having the promise fulfilled. They were all sojourners and exiles, not having received the things promised. But what? Having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear they are what? Seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he is what? Prepared for them a city. Zion, right? Revelation chapter 21. Behold, I saw Zion coming down out of heaven. They were all pilgrims and sojourners and exiles looking for a better land. You and I, if we are Christians, we do not live in this land as permanent residents. That's not how we view our lives. We are here temporarily on our way to somewhere better. And so if I can bring it back to our discussion in 1 Peter chapter 2, he says you need to live as sojourners and as exiles. Why? Because there's a war going on in your flesh. It rages against your soul. And so therefore, you need to do what? Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that they, when they do speak against you. Now, it's interesting. He doesn't say so that they don't speak evil against you. That's not what he says. He says that when they speak against you as evildoers, what's the end result? Because your conduct will win the day when you are focused on Jesus. And they won't be able to continue to speak evil against you, because what you're living for will stand above their accusation, and they'll glorify God in that. They knew someone who was like Jesus. Be holy as I am holy. Any questions about this section? Any other comments? So, simply stating, I think that's the second coming of Jesus, which is the great day that we wait for. It's when God visits us again.
But why would they be glorifying God on that day, like the evil
people? Well, so that's a great question. So, when they says they glorify God on that day, prior to that day, God allows man to make his own choices. And people can deny God. They can speak evil against God. They can blaspheme God. But did they get to do that forever? Every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus is Lord. Every knee will be humbled. And in that day, man can no longer deny God. What does Psalm 14 say? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. God will let you speak foolishly until that day, the day of visitation, when no man can speak foolishly, because God will fully reveal himself and his presence will overwhelm them, and they will all be bowed humbly before him. And so I think when he says glorify God, they'll be left without any choice. That even those who've done evil and wicked in their lives will no longer be able to deny who God is. Good question. Mitch?
The day of visitation,
yeah, that's what I believe it is. I think that's what he's pointing toward. Because it's not until that day that you and I cease to be sojourners and pilgrims. It's only when Jesus returns that we get to go home to the place he's built for us. Good questions. Any others? All right. Well, we're still kind of talking about the same thing a little bit, but he's going to change what he means about holiness in this next section to talk about governing authorities. You could pair this pretty easily with what chapter?
Romans
13. Close, really close there. Romans 13. He says here, 1 Peter 2:13, he says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him, to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. We'll read a little more. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. An interesting section here about submission to authority. He starts by saying in verse 13, be subject to whom? To every human institution, right? First, before we talk about that, word subject, what do we say subject implies? What does that word mean?
Submission?
Yeah, so it's, yeah, like submission. What does it mean? Remember, it's the idea of to put oneself under, right? To sub, right? To submit. You are voluntarily bowing yourself, putting yourself under the hand or authority of someone else. You're giving up control to something. So, talk about human institutions. He gives us a couple examples, doesn't he? He says the emperors, governors, right? Those are a couple. But when we think about human institutions for us, who are human institutions that have authority over us?
The police.
Police. Who?
The IRS.
IRS, yeah, they just showcase themselves.
The police.
Police, governor, right. So we know those, government, right? Government. What about outside of government? We not have any other authorities in our lives? Oh, yeah. Your boss, authority in your life? How would this apply to your boss at work?
Do what you're told, you're going to get fired.
Well, that's true. You might get fired.
Condition of employment, basically. If you come under us, you stay with us, whatever, 40 weeks of place for you to be working.
Yeah. But let's go one step further, not just talk about the bare bones of what's expected of us by the work institution, but what about you as a Christian? And are we limited in our submission to just what the boss requires of us? It does go further, right? Or not?
Yeah, work is whatever for God, not for men.
Okay, work for God, not for men. We have a higher standard of our own conduct than what even the government or our employer, whoever, whatever governing authority has over us. Right? We go beyond that. We're trying to live. We're not trying to get as close to the line they set as we can, but we're trying to stay within the lines we set for ourselves as Christians. He says that we ought to be subject to the emperor. Now that's interesting in the first century context. That's going to be challenging for them, isn't it? Just take, if you just go to Acts chapter 4 and 5, let's see, 4 or 5, yeah, 4 and 5. If you just look at just those two chapters, we see that the early Christians had had opposition from the government. And how were they challenged, and how did they deal with that challenge? Yeah, what I find interesting about it is there is a limit, right, that God has the greater. So if a government authority or any authority in our life is asking us to do something that would be a violation to God, we can't follow that specific order, can we? But through that, do I have then the right to rebel in any way I want to? Even in the situation in the book of Acts, they still made themselves submissive in the ways they could. They were still willing to go to jail as punishment, not because they deserved to, but they didn't stand up and try to rebel and fight their way out of the prison, did they? No, they still submitted. But in their submission, they let them know there was a point where they could no longer submit, and that was, we can't shut up. We will continue to proclaim God's good news. And so, as Christians, it can be tricky. We have to live in those moments. Now, fortunately for us, none of us are facing that. So, as I mentioned Wednesday, it's a lot easier to talk about these things in the abstract. When it's not affecting me directly, I can talk about, you know, the principles of if I was in that situation. But if we don't discuss them now, before it happens, we may be left without knowing what to do when it does come. Sometimes, but not all the time, right?
Set free by God miraculously, you know, and the authority would just
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, teachers aren't supposed to talk about God at school. That's sort of like, I mean, I know a friend of ours that still did, but you know, they're not. I mean, there's supposed to be a separation that you're not supposed to do.
Yeah, and see, that's when it gets tricky, right? And what do you do? You know, we have to continue to live as Christians, and we have... So what do you do?
He still talked about God. He never got into trouble for it, but he could have.
Yeah, and... are we willing to suffer punishment because of it? And that's the difficulty of all of this. So we as Christians, we have to submit. We don't have the option to rebel. And what's interesting, when you continue on, let's see, in this next section, we're continuing in the same theme of obedience to authority. We talked about this on Wednesday, so I won't rehash all this, but I'll just introduce this. He says, now to servants, and it's the word bond servant or slave, so he's talking to those in slavery. So there were Christians in the first century who were slaves. He says, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but to what? To the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? Interesting question, isn't it? He goes on, he says, but if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. I'll have to stop here, but there's a little more in this chapter we'll talk about next week. But again, as we mentioned Wednesday night, as slaves, can slaves just rebel against their masters? We're not people of rebellion. We're people who submit where we can. Again, it's easy to talk about these things in the abstract. We're not in slavery. There's no slaves in this room. Yet what is going on in the first century are men and women who were in bondage. Now, some of those had masters who treated them well. Others did not. Others were in very difficult situations. How do you as a Christian respond in those situations?
Could we look at this in the light of employee?
No. This is not employee, right? There's a distinct difference right here. I think the first section goes more to employees. But I don't think we should belittle like what these people had to endure as servants. Now, again, as we mentioned, when we talk about slavery in the first century, we do need to know that there were different kinds of slavery. And again, the Bible never endorses kidnapping slavery, man-stealing. It actually speaks evil of it. But there were some who were in that. Again, think about the ones we just know from the text. Joseph was stolen from his homeland and sold into slavery. You think about Daniel. Daniel was a man who was sold into, or was taken in war as a slave, along with many, many others. This was a cold reality for them. And so for them as Christians, how were they to respond? Well, both Paul and Peter say that in that moment, you don't have a call to rebellion. That's not who you're supposed to be. You work. You do your best, even in a very difficult situation, and you do it for the glory of God. And so he says in verse 20, for what credit is it if when you sin, you're beaten for it? I mean, beaten. That's what it says. That's what they endured. That didn't happen in the workplace. If it does, then you need to go seek a lawyer out. So I think it's important for us to see that these things are real. And yet God caused them to live honorably, even in very harsh, difficult circumstances. He says it's a gracious thing in the sight of God. Because ultimately, who do we bring glory to when we can succeed in being holy in difficult situations? We honor God. Any other questions or comments about that? All right, everybody got all quiet. So we'll come back. I do want to talk about the end of this. He'll come back to Jesus. And we'll get into chapter 3, some important things in chapter 3 with husbands and wives. Maybe I can get in trouble there too, talking about that. We'll look at that next week. And then we'll hopefully get to the end of chapter 3. Not next week, 2 weeks. Nope, not 2 weeks. I won't be here. So we'll do this in 3 weeks. We'll come back and look at the end of chapter 2 and get into chapter 3 then.